a Hillbop, in his opinion, may well, though it's hard to tell, you don't make definitive statements about this kind of thing, may well continue to brighten through the month of April. And should that occur, we are in for the comet of a lifetime, folks, because it's already the comet. I have never in all my life seen a comet as bright and as spectacular as Hale-Bopp was yesterday morning. And to imagine that it may continue brightening through April is to imagine an event that is going to spark the human imagination beyond belief. I mean, it is a natural wonder and sight to behold. So, next week, we will have as a guest, I can't tell you which night just yet, Alan Hale. The Alan Hale of Hale-Bopp, yes, indeed. This morning, if you live in an area where it is clear, by all means, I'm telling you, get out there, stay up another couple of hours if you can manage it, and you will be treated to the sight of your life. Now, I know in the Northwest it's cloudy right now, and you might as well pack it in and go to bed with regard to seeing the comet. Not my show, of course. But in other parts of the country, I mean, go check and see if it's clear. If it is, about an hour, hour and a half before a sunrise, you're going to get a real treat. This is worth losing sleep over. If you have a clear night, wake up about 1 hour before sunrise, just go outside, look to the east, and then slightly to the north, and about 30 or 40 degrees above the horizon, and you will be treated to a naked eye display of what looks like it's going to be the biggest, most spectacular comet of our lifetimes. With your naked eye, you can see a kind of a fuzzy star that looks to be just under the brightness of Venus, and that's very bright. And you can see with your naked eye the corona, and with a good pair of binoculars, you can see a good close-up of a comet, and it is a whiz banger, folks. Trust me on this.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening. Is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. And it is going to be an interesting show this morning. We're going to talk comets with Dr. Alan Hale, who is the co-discoverer of the Hale-Bopp comet. And we're going to try and drill into some brains out there that you've got to get your butt out the door and take a look at this thing, because it's not something that you have to go search real hard for at the right time. You go out and it hits you right in the eye, as long as you've got a relatively cloudless sky. It is the comet of your lifetime, I believe. And it's being undercovered in the media. But moved with his family to Alamogordo, New Mexico later that year, where he lived until his graduation from high school in 1976, then attending the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. After graduating from there in 1980 with a bachelor's degree in physics, he was stationed at various assignments in San Diego and Long Beach. After getting out of the Navy in 1983, worked for 2.5 years as an engineering contractor for the Deep Space Network at JPL in Pasadena, was involved, among other things, with the Voyager 2 encounter with the planet Uranus in 1986. Later that year, left JPL, returned to New Mexico in order to attend graduate school at New Mexico State University, earned his Ph.D. in astronomy from NMSU, New Mexico University, in 1992, and during the following year, founded and became director of the Southwest Institute for Space Research. Now based in Cloudcroft, New Mexico, the Institute is an independent research organization that strives to enhance the scientific literacy of the general public through the providing of opportunities for direct participation in research programs and through other educational activities. His professional interests include the study of stars like the Sun
and the search for other solar systems, including those that may contain planets similar to Earth. He has authored several research papers in this field. He is also interested in the present efforts to identify potential Earth-impacting asteroids and comets, and is currently engaged in initiating a search program for these objects to be conducted from southern New Mexico, which will include participation by school students and the general public. He, of course, is the co-discoverer of Comet Hale-Bopp. That was in July of 1995. And now from New Mexico, and here to tell us which city will be impacted by Comet Hale-Bopp and which Pleiadium beam ship is lurking behind the comet carrying thousands of green people, is Alan Hale. Alan, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. I hope you have a sense of humor.
You have to ask the people who know me. Some may say I do, some may say I don't.
I see. All right. Well, before the night's over, I'm sure we'll find out. Let us begin, I guess, Alan, by airing the fact that we did have differences. We did. Way back when the Courtney Brown affair began, I was upset with you over the Chuck Schrammick business, and I'm sure you were upset with me over the way I handled the news or the information I received from Chuck Schrammick and from Professor Brown. And so all of that did occur, and if you have any comments on it, I think you referred to my program as the Weekly World News of Radio, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had all that happen between us, but it is my view that what's going on in our sky right now is a whole lot more important than any differences we had. And I think we're both willing to let those go, and you've got a hell of a comet out there, my friend. I get every single morning, because of my hours, Alan, after the show, I go out and take a look, and this comet is nothing short of incredible. What is going on? Well, no, take me back. Take me back. I'm sure everybody wants to know, to the day you discovered this comet.
Okay.
What was it like?
Well, it was an ordinary old night, really, although it was a very gorgeous one. As in that bio sheet that I sent you, I follow known comets as a hobby. There's usually two or three or more visible with a decent telescope on any given clear night, if you know what you're looking for. And there's overwhelming majority of those things are dinky little fuzzy things that very few people pay attention to, except for those of us who actually do follow and study these things.
Mm.
And I had gone out that evening to look at the two comets I was following. If you're familiar with the weather in this part of the country, you probably are. And we get a lot of rain that time of the year.
Oh, well, of course, we have our problems for a while in the Southwest, but most of the year it's good.
Yeah, most of the year it's pretty good, but that time of the year we get a lot of rain in this part of the country. And it was the first clear night we'd had in about a week and a half because of all the rain. And anyway, I'd gone out to look at the two comets, and I had finished with the first one and realized I had about an hour to wait before the other comet rose above my house, so I have an hour to kill.
Mm.
And it was a gorgeous night. It can be very beautiful in this part of the country. And I thought I'd just pass the time by looking at some star clusters, gas clouds, various objects like that, mm-hmm. in the Milky Way, including in Sagittarius. And I turned a telescope towards one star cluster in Sagittarius and looked at the eyepiece, and I happened to see a little fuzzy thing nearby.
A little fuzzy thing nearby.
Yeah.
And I guess we should explain to people, and I'm a layman now, and so you'll have to help me, but fuzzy, stars shouldn't be fuzzy, should they?
No, they're not. Their stars are little points of light, presuming you've got everything focused right.
Sure. Fuzzy thing means generally what? Corona or is it coma?
It could mean a lot of things. There's a lot of fuzzy objects in the sky, star clusters, galaxies, gas clouds.
Okay.
And the sky is riddled with these things, as any would-be comet discoverer quickly learns. So the sky is completely littered with these things, which is why we have star atlases, which tell us what's where, and which is one of the very first things I did was to check my star atlases to see if there was anything plotted in that position. and there didn't seem to be anything. There was a star cluster that I was looking at. Of course, that was plotted, but there wasn't anything plotted around it.
There wasn't supposed to be a fuzzy thing there.
It didn't seem to be.
Mm-hmm.
So the one dead giveaway for a comet is a comet will move against the background stars over a period of a couple of hours.
Sure.
Since they're members of the solar system. So I went ahead and just sketched the little fuzzy thing and the stars that were around it. And then went into my office to see, you know, go through all the catalogs just to make sure there's nothing cataloged in that position. There didn't seem to be anything.
When did your heart begin to beat a little faster?
It was starting, I guess, to do this as I was going along on kind of a gradually increasing basis.
Uh-huh.
I did one other check because I wanted to see if there were any known comets in that position. So I logged on to the Internet, logged on to the computer at the Central Bureau for Astronomical Telegrams in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or the world's clearinghouse for reporting and announcing comet discoveries, and they have all the information that's necessary there. Ran their comet identification program to see if there were any comets in that position. It said there were none. So it was very interesting by this point.
I bet.
Yeah, I've got an object. It doesn't seem to be anything listed at that position, either galaxies or comets or anything. I actually did send a tentative email to the Central Bureau telling them I had a possible comet at that point. And then I went outside and looked through the eyepiece of the telescope, and I saw beyond all doubt that the thing had moved. So I knew I had a comet at this point.
So now you know you've got a comet.
Yeah.
At this point, one question would be, why does Alan Hale get to discover a comet when there's all these great big university telescopes out there? I mean, gigantic telescopes, and yet Alan Hale, in his backyard, is finding this comet, and they're not. How come?
Usually the large telescopes at the observatories like Kitt, Peak, Palomar, Mauna Kea, and all these places around the world, they're very large instruments with very small fields, and they're dedicated to looking at very specific objects. Mm-hmm. And they're not engaged in survey work, you know, covering large areas of the sky. Somebody has research projects where they're looking at very specific objects.
So then it's actually more likely that an amateur would discover a comet than one of the university telescopes.
Yes, it is.
Okay. So now at this point, you think you've got a comet. What are the odds that somebody else, the mysterious, I might add, Mr. Bob, and I'm going to ask you about that, would discover a comet at exactly the same time?
Ordinarily, they would be pretty slim. But since this comet was next to a fairly well-known star cluster, really anyone who was looking at that star cluster at that same time, that same night, should have seen the same object.
Would have gone, wow, what's that?
Yeah. In fact, I was surprised that there was only one other report.
Oh, so was that report lodged roughly at the same time, prior to you, just after you, or how did that work?
It was after me. Tom Bopp actually saw the object right around the same time I did. We were certainly within a few minutes of each other. And to be truthful, neither one of us really knows who was first, because neither of us bothered to check our watches at that particular point in time.
Okay.
But
I'm sure.
Yeah. But I had an unfair advantage over Tom. I work at home. My computer is here. I went inside and sent an email. It was pretty quick. Tom was in the desert 90 miles away from anywhere. He had to hop into his car and drive home and send a telegram. So my report beat his by a few hours.
So I take it at some point then, after they had come back to you and told you, oh, yes, you found a comet. Guess what, folks? You found a comet.
Mm-hmm.
Then how do they arbitrate what the comet is to be called, the namesake, how it all shakes out? Mm-hmm. Who arbitrates that?
Okay. Well, there's a long-standing tradition that goes back over two centuries now that comets are named after the people who discover them.
Sure.
There is now a committee of astronomers who are members of the International Astronomical Union who are tasked with the responsibility of naming a comet. And the usual procedure now is we wait a few days till we get an orbit for the comet to make sure it's not some long-lost object that's been lost. We don't want to add a bunch of names to it unnecessarily. So as soon as we have an orbit for a comet, they will then go ahead and name it. And so this is usually 2 or 3 days.
All right. I've got a whole series of questions about Hale Bopp. The first one is, even some major university astronomers were puzzled that Hale Bopp went out beyond the orbit of Venus, you know, way out there, seemed to be...
Orbit of Jupiter, you mean.
Jupiter, I'm sorry. Seemed to be so bright unaccountably bright, outgassing like crazy, more outgassing than should occur for the amount of energy available from the sun to be causing that. And for that reason, a lot of them back then were saying, we think this is first time round for Hale-Bopp.
No, they really weren't quite saying that. The comet was definitely very active and very bright. In fact, unprecedentedly bright for a comet at that distance. Although we do occasionally see comets that have outbursts, which blow off material for some for reasons which we don't entirely understand yet. At that distance, there's, in fact, there's one comet that travels around the sun in almost circular orbit between Jupiter and Saturn, and usually is a very dim object. But every once in a while, every once or twice a year or so, blows off material, brightens up for 2 or 3 weeks, mm-hmm. And then fades, kind of fades around again until 6 or 8 months later when it blows again. So and there was some thought that the comet was actually something like this. Tom and I just happened to spy this thing when it was going through such an outburst like that. And, of course, it turns out it wasn't. The comet continued to brighten at that point. It didn't fade away.
So then we don't really fully understand the physics behind what can cause that kind of an outburst that far away from an energy source that could cause it, huh?
Well, we... I mean, there clearly are packets of volatile materials underneath the surfaces of these dirty snowballs, as it were. There was some question for a little while as to what was driving all this activity. We knew it couldn't be water. We know the main constituent of a comet nucleus is water, and we're definitely too far out at that point part of the solar system for water to start sublimating.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a question for a month or two exactly what was causing all the activity. Once some people were able to observe this with the appropriate radio telescopes, they were able to see the signatures of carbon monoxide. And carbon monoxide will sublimate at the temperatures at which the comet was experiencing at that time.
Ah.
So that could be it. We had a handle within a month or so that, yeah, the activity we're seeing is driven by carbon monoxide. The question that I think was in a lot of our minds then was, well, is this really just a carbon monoxide-rich comet? How's the water ratio compared to carbon monoxide? That we had to wait about a year before we really started seeing water kick in earnest, which it did.
How big is Hale-Bopp?
Good question. We really don't know. We can't really see the nucleus in this thing. The cloud of material around it is just so thick that we really just can't see the nucleus. If we could do like we did with Halley 11 years ago, send a spacecraft by, take images, it's very easy to get a nucleus by that way. Comet Hyakutake a year ago came by close enough to the Earth where people out of JPL were able to bounce radar beams off the nucleus and get a return signal and get a size estimate that way.
Huh.
But we can't do that with Hale-Bopp. We're not sending any spacecraft out to it, unfortunately. And it's not coming close enough to the Earth to do a radar experiment, unfortunately.
How about a best guess?
The best guess we have right now, and this was taken with Hubble Space Telescope images back in the fall of 1995, with a few assumptions throw in, the diameter we came up with was something like 40 kilometers or 25 miles. But there are so many assumptions that went into that figure that even people who came up with it said take it with a grain of salt.
Early on, when the comet was first discovered, they were coming up with some pretty big figures. I recall over 100 miles in diameter. And that still really could be?
Probably not. The Hubble data that we got from the fall of 95 that I was just referring to suggests an upper limit of about 70 kilometers.
70 kilometers. Still a big piece of ice.
Still a pretty big piece of ice. Again, 40 was the most likely value. Again, put that word most likely in quote marks.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be quite a bit smaller. It depends on how much the surface is active and a lot of things that we really can't tell. We had to make a few assumptions.
All right, to dispel all rumors that have been floating around on the Internet for a long time, I have a little stack of them here that talk about course corrections.
Okay.
I take it that you've not noted any course corrections thus far with Hale-Bopp.
Okay, let me tell you what I believe is for the probable start of that whole business. Once the comet's discovered, the idea is, what's its orbit? Astronomers from around the world, needs to be both professional and amateur astronomers, will go out and make precise measurements of its position.
Mm-hmm.
Then once we have a baseline of usually 2 or 3 days, we can calculate an orbit and see what the comet's doing. How far out is it? How close is it going to get to the sun, Earth, and so on? Hale-Bopp presented a very difficult case because it was so far out, it was very difficult to get any kind of a decent orbit for it. In fact, the first orbit, which was published, I guess, 3 or 4 days after its discovery, did indicate that it was far out and was coming in close, but that it was so uncertain. I mean, really, they had almost nothing to work with.
So in other words, as they refined the orbit of Hale-Bopp, it appeared to some people that these were course corrections.
Right. It was actually just a refinement of the orbit based on the data. It was really almost 2 weeks before Brian Marson at the Central Bureau was able to finally get a valid, decent orbit out of the data he had. I mean, the original orbit that was published a week and a half earlier was based on almost nothing, but they wanted to get some kind of an orbit out just to have a vague idea of what this thing is doing.
All right. In my lifetime, there have been a number of comets that have really been given big billing. Boy, the media just went bonkers, and this is going to be the most incredible thing you ever saw. And it poops out. And that has happened several times in my life. Hyakutake was kind of an interesting surprise. But finally, we have a comet that is either meeting or exceeding the expectations. And the media, for some reason, is so silent about it. And we'll address that at the bottom of the hour. That's what I want to ask you about when we come back. You remember that, folks? You remember it? It's going to be the comet of the century with these other comets. And then all of a sudden, it just sort of, it's like somebody turns the dimmer down and it doesn't meet expectations. Well, guess what? This one does. All these other years of publicity about comets, they were going to be a big deal and pooped out totally. And here, your comet, or everybody's comet, is really living up to or exceeding expectations. And I guess that, too, is a question. And we're not getting the big network publicity that we ought to be getting. What's going on?
I'm not sure I entirely agree with that contention, although I guess I have a biased viewpoint to some extent. I would like to see this thing get as much publicity as it absolutely could. And if you had been around me, say, the past 3 or 4 weeks or so and listened to my phone ring off the wall, you would dispute the contention that it's not getting any publicity.
Well, when I said that, I guess I meant I don't see it. Well, all right, you give me the name. What was the name of that big comet that pooped out?
You may be referring to Comet Kohoutek back in the early 1970s.
I certainly am.
Okay.
And the networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, they were all hyping it up like crazy. It's going to be incredible. And then it pooped out.
Yeah, although I don't know how much, I don't remember how long before its actual peak display the press really started coming out in the big. My experience has been the public seems to have a rather short attention span. And even though we've known about Hale-Bopp for a year and a half, and we've known that at least it possessed the potential for a decent display for that long, it seemed like nobody was paying too much attention to it, with a few exceptions, I guess you being one of them, until fairly recently. Now, my experience is now is that the press is discovering this thing, and I have had phone calls and interviews with CNN, I've had discussions with and some of the networks already, some of the major news magazines and so on. So it is starting to get some publicity right now. Of course, here we are approaching peak display within the next month or so.
All right. That is the next question. What's forecast? If you can do a comet forecast.
Okay. Keep in mind there's always amount of guesswork involved, and as my good friend David Levy, who's the Levy and Shoemaker, Levy 9, by the way, he has a quote that I really love to use, and that's, comets are like cats. They have tails, and they do whatever they want. And there's a lot of truth to that.
Oh, yes, there is.
The comet is closest to the Earth on March 22nd and closest to the Sun on April 1st, which means that, theoretically speaking, the comet should be brightest right around the end of this month, beginning of April.
Which is the more important date, the proximity to Earth or the proximity to the Sun?
I don't really think there's either that's really more important than the other.
In terms of possible brightness?
Probably the Sun.
The Sun.
It's probably more important than the proximity to the Earth, because it's not, although this is such a big bright comet, I don't think either specific date is more important than any other one.
It's true.
My feeling is that the comet will probably be at its best by maybe the second week of April for a couple of reasons. One is the comet by that time gets high and well-placed in the evening sky. And I, for some strange reason, people are much more willing to go out and see something in the evening than they are to get up before dawn and look at something.
True.
Also, usually a comet will have its best dust tail development after it has rounded the sun and is heading back out.
Can I ask a dumb pedestrian question? When you're looking at the comet, and it is closer to the horizon, would it be true that you're looking through an awful lot more atmosphere than when it gets up higher and you're looking more or less, not straight up, but more or less vertically?
Yes. So comet is, and for all objects in the sky for that matter, are more prominent when they're above the horizon, so you're not looking through as much crud.
Okay.
So, and so by the second week of April or so, the comet is well up above the horizon. It's not as close. It's higher up. And you've got, at least if this comet follows the traditional thing that comets are supposed to do, whether or not this one will do it, it remains to be seen. You'll probably have our longest and our brightest tail right around that time. It seems to be the tail makes the comet more than anything else, at least to the average person.
Oh, I don't know about that. I guess I would have said that before I saw yours, or ours, or whoever it belongs to. It is spectacular. In fact, people have no idea, those who have been too lazy so far, to get up early and lose a little sleep and go out and look. I took my wife out, who has seen a comet or two, Hagasaki and others, and I took her out about a week and a half ago, and she said, holy smokes, or some derivation of that, and that's how surprised she was and how dramatic it is. I mean, it really is dramatic. Now, as you know, I got a really nice mead for Christmas telescope. And I find less magnification, more to provide a better view of the comet. I can't quite figure out why that is.
Okay, usually when you have a telescope, you're on an object this size, you're actually cutting your field down too much. You want really as wide a field as you can to grab it more of the outside detail, especially when you start looking at the tails and some of these maybe lower brightness structures. When you're putting on a telescope like that and putting on a magnification, you're almost looking right through it. And that really kind of tends to lessen the contrast, and you're not getting as much. Now, a telescope will certainly give you a lot of very exciting views of what's going on in the middle of the coma.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you've got...
Actually, it was brighter and much more of a pinpoint with the telescope, more like a star, frankly, and then, of course, I could see the coma, but I was right in the middle of it, so so you're correct about that.
Yeah, in fact, if you might have also seen there's a lot of jets going off in that comet, an incredible amount of activity going on. It's really
incredible. As a matter of fact, Doctor, the recent space shuttle mission... there was radio commentary, and others have said that they see two tails. Can that be?
Yes. I'm seeing two tails myself.
Oh, you are?
Yes. The tails are made of different substances. The one tail is made of ionized gas. As the comet gets closer to the sun, the solar wind starts to ionize some of the molecules that are being blown off the nucleus. The solar wind blows that back, so you're seeing ions. It's kind of, in a way, it's almost like a neon sign that you're seeing, except different chemicals, different molecules. And that is the tail. It's the dimmer of the tail, at least to the eye. It's the one that's kind of hangs straight. It's the one that's to the north, or if you're in the northern hemisphere, it's the one that's on the left side and hanging straight. The molecules tend to fluoresce in the blue part of the spectrum, where our eyes aren't all that sensitive. So it looks dim to the eye, although if you're in a dark side, you can see it pretty easily. The other tail is made of dust particles that have been blown off the surface of this nucleus and then being blown off the comet itself. Each little dust particle goes into its own orbit around the sun, and they tend to lag behind the comet a little bit, so you'll see this very broad, curved tail, and that's the dust tail. And that, since that's reflecting sunlight, that tail tends to be brighter to our own eyes than the other tail.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And there were some early pictures taken of the comet that could use some explaining. One was on the Hale-Bopp.com site itself called Hale-Bopp's Eyes. What's your best take on what that was? It seemed to show two equally bright comets side by side.
I took a brief look at that picture. My feeling is that that was just probably an artifact in the electronic CCD camera that was used. I happened to be looking at the comet that very same night that photo was taken, and there I didn't see anything unusual about it. So more than likely, at least my feeling is that it was just an artifact, a cosmic ray hit, an artifact in the processing of CCD images. I'm not an expert, really, in taking CCD images, but I've taken some, and a lot of cosmic ray hits, just glitches in the software, can produce things like this. So it's not all that unusual.
All right. I want to read you something and see if this makes any sense to you, and have you explain what it means to me. Here we go. This is written by an astronomer named Mike. I can't identify better than that. We lost 3.5 days of our recent observing run due to a winter storm, but managed to obtain a total of 6 hours observing on the comet. The water production rate is running about 1E31 molecules / per second, and the spectral lines are bright. However, the continuum longward of 3 UM, whatever that is, has brightened enormously since January 21st, so the line continuum brightness ratio is small. This is getting tough. Typically 0.1 for bright lines. This is similar to Comet Hyakutake during the IRTF TO team survey in mid-April of 96, in contrast sharply with our PI team, don't fall asleep folks, data of March 23rd and 24th. We believe, this is the interesting line, we believe we are seeing the signature of organic grain emission in the continuum intensity versus wavelength. What does that mean?
Okay. Organic molecules simply mean molecules which contain carbon. There are a lot of substances which contain carbon. Of course, a lot of the chemicals within our own bodies are carbon compounds. So there's this impression, which is maybe half true, that we're talking organic chemistry, and organic compounds, we're talking life, because life is carbon-based. But there are plenty of other compounds which contain carbon, which really have nothing to do with life. Hydrocarbons, you know, smog, formaldehyde, and you know, various other substances of that nature. We know that comets contain a fair amount of organic materials. During the return of Halley 11 years ago, specifically the spacecraft flybys, like the European Space Agency's Giotto mission, detected a large number of organic molecules in and around Halley.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Let's back way up, and let me ask you, what is a comet? I mean, I know it's made of ice and some of the rest of things we've talked about, but why do we have comets cosmically? Where are they from?
Okay, they are the leftovers from the days the planets in the solar system formed about 4.5 billion years ago. We have, if you look out in space, you will see large clouds of gas and dust scattered at various locations. And these dust clouds very often are sites of active star formation. You see clumps starting to break off, starting to collapse. As they collapse and start to spin up, the material will start to fall into a disk surrounding the central star. And so you have dust disk, if I said that right, in orbit around a star, and give this as these things orbit around the sun, each dust grain, eventually one dust grain will collide with another dust grain and stick together. Now you have a bigger dust grain, which has more gravity than anything else, and so it is able to attract another dust grain. So then you have yet a bigger dust grain, and give this process a few million years to go on. Eventually you have large chunks of material, maybe a few miles across.
Like when you made a ball of aluminum when you were a kid out of a little piece
somewhat,
of aluminum.
Yeah.
All right, is this then part of a continuing process of creation, or is it a result of the old Big Bang?
No, this is the Big Bang. When we talk about the Big Bang, we're actually talking about the formation of the entire universe, which preceded this by some time. We're talking processes which have been taking place since then, the actual formation of stars. And some of the elements that we see in the gas and dust clouds in interstellar space actually are the result of older stars which have gone supernova and blew a lot of material into space and enriched the material, the gas and dust we see in space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've seen some pictures taken from Hubble of what appear to be the actual birthing of stars, some of the most incredible photographs I've ever seen.
Yeah, there's that one that I call the lava lamp image. That's a real gorgeous image.
It really is. And is that what it is, the formation, the actual birth of stars? Do you believe that's what we're seeing?
Yes, it is what we're seeing. I mean, of course, the star formation process is something which takes place over a period of tens of millions of years. And, of course, we're here, you know, our existence, right, is a very tiny fraction of that.
Yes.
So, and if we were able to come back and look at that exact same part of the sky 5 million years from now, we would see it looking quite a bit different. We'd see stars there that we don't really see right now, because those stars will have formed, will start to have blown some of their dust envelopes away, and so on. I mean, this is a process which, on our human time scale, takes an enormously long amount of time, although on an astronomical time scale, it's actually not that long.
Doctor, in the universe, do you think it more likely that life is prolific or non-existent on the scale that we have it here on Earth?
Okay. In a way, this is a matter of opinion, because we have a sample of one to work with.
Yes.
Although, depending on how the results are, the Martian fossils that were putatively announced last year, that may give us a sample, too, if that turns out to be verified. But my own personal feeling is that we know life got started here on the Earth, and it's hard to believe that life would be so rare, the processes would actually be so rare that it would only take place once. If it, the same physics and the same chemistry that works here in on Earth should work everywhere else throughout the universe. If life got started here, life should therefore get started as long as the environmental conditions are suitable anywhere, really, not the universe. So my own feeling is that there is probably a lot of life throughout the universe.
Creation, evolution, common, not rare. Okay, enter the comet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it possible that a comet, remember when you're a kid and you had a daisy, and you went, and the seeds went everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Is a comet possibly a sort of a universal Johnny Appleseed delivering the seeds of life?
Oh, that idea has been batted around occasionally. I don't think there's a lot of support or a lot of evidence for that particular idea. One idea which does have some support and among a lot of astronomers is, we know that one of the primary constituents of a comet is water.
Right.
We know that the Earth has a fair amount of water, and we know that the Earth was formed by the colliding of these chunks that I was referring to a few minutes ago,
mm-hmm.
over a period of tens to hundreds of millions of years, and of course during the millions of years that have elapsed since its formation. We know the comets have hit it, and the comets have delivered water. They must have delivered water, since that's what they're made of, to the Earth. So it is very possible that at least some amount of the Earth's water that we have right now is due to cometary impacts over its history.
Is there any other way you can imagine that there appears to be water on the moon?
That would be the by far the most likely source of it. Keeping in mind that the reports that came out last year, which I'm sure are the ones you're referring to, the Clementine data,
uh-huh.
We haven't verified that that's water ice yet. We've got an interesting radar signal. In fact, it was the result of a deliberate search, but that's really all it is right now. Now, the Lunar Prospector mission, which is supposed to be launched later this year, is designed to verify that one way or the other, whether or not we're actually seeing water ice at the moon's south pole. If we do, cometary impacts is almost certainly where that water came from.
How big were the chunks of Shoemaker-Levy 9 as compared to what we believe the size of Hale-Bopp to be?
Hale-Bopp appears to be much larger.
Larger.
Yeah. The largest chunk which hit Jupiter from Shoemaker-Levy 9, I've seen various figures on this, but the one I've seen the most common was probably on the order of about 1 kilometer across.
1 kilometer?
Yeah. Not all that big, really. Of course, there was 20-some chunks of various sizes, and that was about the largest one. So the overall object may have been 3 or 4 kilometers or so.
Okay, well, check me if I'm wrong, but I believe that I read somewhere that the marks left on Jupiter that we were able to observe from these impacts,
mm-hmm.
were some of which were the size of Earth?
Yes.
Size of Earth?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you had a chance to actually see those. Those big scars were visible in a pretty small telescope. It was amazing. Fantastic thing to see.
So then it leads me to the question, should, which it will not, Hale-Bopp impact Earth or the moon or something, even Mars, what would happen?
The planet would go on its merry way.
I mean, I beg your pardon?
The moon or Earth or whatever object got hit would just go on its merry way. I mean, yeah, Hale-Bopp is a large object for a comet, say, but compared to the mass of, say, the Earth, it's nothing. It's trivial. It's not even worth...
Okay, the Earth would go on its merry... would we go on our merry way?
No, we would not.
We wouldn't, eh?
Yeah, it would be pretty bad news for the any life forms on the Earth. The Cretaceous-Tertiary impact of 65 million years ago, which most of us have now come to believe was what caused the dinosaurs to die out, was probably an object quite a bit smaller than Hale-Bopp. I think the estimates that I've seen usually say something like 6 miles or so.
All right, and we're a whole lot smaller than dinosaurs. Doctor, stand by. We'll be back to you. This is CBC. Saturn-like object, the companion, spaceships following Hale-Bopp, blah, blah, blah. We could go on and on. How did you react?
The first indication I got of anything like this was the morning after the broadcast of your show where this was discussed. There was a radio station in Cincinnati called me about 8 o'clock that morning and asked, what do you think about this mysterious spacecraft that's following your comet?
Ah, and what did you say?
Say what?
Say what? I'm sure.
And I started getting phone calls and emails all day long from all over the place asking my opinion of this thing. I thought, well, let's see what's going on here. So I was finally, through some of the local media folks around here kind of pointed me where this was coming from. Finally was able to look at Mr. Shramik's webpage, and that kind of pretty much told me everything I needed to know, except for the fact I hadn't seen the image itself. And finally I was able to track down a copy of that image, and I pretty much recognized immediately what it was. I could tell right away it was a bright star that was in the field. But to me, it's not enough just to say, well, it's a bright star because I said so. I went and dug up what's called the Palomar Sky Survey, has been digitized and put on the World Wide Web. And I went ahead and got on the web, downloaded a copy of that particular same part of the sky, was able to match the stars in Mr. Shramik's image with the star field on the Palomar Sky Survey, and sure enough, there is a very bright star in the exact same position as his object.
How did he manage to get that Saturn-like appearance, or what appeared to be rings, when other stars in the same image didn't have them? Why would that have occurred?
Because it is by far the brightest star in that image. The other stars that are in his image are quite a bit dimmer than that. And essentially, once you start overexposing any stellar image on an astronomical photograph, you start to get what are called diffraction effects. If you look at that exact same field on the Palomar Sky Survey image that I was just referring to, you will also see diffraction spikes in the very same star. Again, because the star image is overexposed. And it's just a common effect. It's due to the optics inside the telescope itself.
Then there were kind of a series, the Courtney Brown image aside for a moment, there were a series of other images that seemed to beg questions, one from Japan and so forth and so on, that seemed to show anomalies of varying sorts. And I'm sure you were presented with those or saw them.
Actually, I kind of ignored them.
Ignored them?
Yeah, because I knew that this object was a star, and that was the whole thing started because that was, you know, the object was a star, and people were starting to see various things in various images. So I was actually out of town during most of this.
Ah.
And
all right, comets are said, now this is mythology and legend and Native American lore, but obviously comets are said to be harbingers of change. And I'm sure you get a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Could there, you know, at the basis, at the bottom of a lot of what is called myth, there's some grain of truth. And let's see, comets as harbingers of change, where might such a myth have come from?
Actually, it's not that hard to understand. Put yourself back in the shoes of someone who was living, say, 500 or 600 years ago. The people then were familiar, of course, with the normal nighttime star patterns that they saw and that we see today.
Right.
They were familiar with the planets. They knew the planets moved against the background stars, but people had known of the planet for centuries at that time. Their motions were understood. Now imagine, here's this bright, impressive comet, and you yourself are well aware of how impressive Hale-Bopp has been.
Oh, yes.
So imagine something like this kind of appearing, almost from out of nowhere sometimes, being this bright, impressive, beautiful object hanging around in the sky, moving against the background stars like the planets do, but maybe in parts of the sky where the planets don't go, like Hale-Bopp is doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then fading off back into nowhere, say, a couple of months later. I think it was only natural to associate that event in the sky with anything that was happening on Earth. Now, if you think about it, there's always something rotten happening on Earth.
That's true.
There's always a war. Rulers always die. There's an assassination. There's a plague or an earthquake or you name it. And I think it was only natural to associate that those events on Earth with the comet that was in the sky at that time, forgetting that 2 years ago, when there was no comet in the sky, there were still bad events happening, but people would make dissociation with the events that happened when the comet was in the sky. And comets ended up getting this bad rap that when there's a comet in the sky, something bad happens.
Well,
it always does, because there's always something bad happening.
Well, maybe it's a little like the virgins tossed into the volcano business. Volcanoes erupt, and then eventually they stop erupting. And if you throw a virgin in, when they stop, you might conclude, therefore,
mm-hmm.
that the virgin stopped the volcano.
Right.
Same theory?
Yeah. I mean, I've had somebody point out to me, kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, comets are associated with the death of rulers sometimes. That's always been one of the things that comets are supposed to foretell. Hale-Bopp is in the sky. Deng Xiaoping just died.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, now the fact that he was 90-something may or may not have had anything to do with that, but...
That's right. Listen, we're heard all over the world, and I've got a fax here that says, Hi, Art, Mark from Sydney, Australia. Do you know, or could you please ask Alan, whether I can see Comet Hale-Bopp in the southern skies? So,
okay.
What about somebody way down in Australia?
Okay, right now he is out of luck.
Oh.
Hale-Bopp right now is strictly a northern hemisphere object. But do not despair too much. After the comet has rounded the sun in early April, it starts to head south very quickly. We, in our latitudes, will lose it, around the 22nd, 25th of May, because it's heading south. Meanwhile, our good friends like Mark and Sydney will start to pick up the comet very low in their northwest about the beginning of May, and as the weeks progress, it will get higher in the southern hemisphere sky and should still be fairly bright at that time.
However, it is at that point leaving the proximity of the sun, right?
Right. So it's going to be fading, and it will probably have faded some by that point, but it should still be a fairly bright and impressive object. And in fact, going back to a comment I made a little bit earlier, it's after the comet has gone around the sun is one times when you have your best tail development. So they may actually have a very impressive object, maybe not quite as bright as what we had had in early April, but may actually have a fairly decent tail, bright tail associated with this thing.
Are you tempted to want to fly to Australia and see it from there?
I am working on a trip to do just that.
I'll be darned.
I may actually get to meet Mark from Sydney.
I see.
I've been to Australia several times. It's a lovely place, and I look for any excuse I can to go there.
Well, that's a good one. All right. What is the best viewing time for us, and does it vary in the U.S. From where we are in the southwest, say, to the northeast corridor or Florida? Does it vary at all?
Not really. It's because the comet's basically visible in the same location from anywhere on the Earth. Just that, you know, as the Earth turns, obviously, you know, the hours are different depending on where you're located, whether North America or Europe or wherever. Right now, the comet, as you know, is a morning object, although it is far enough north now that it is starting to become visible in the evening sky during dusk, but very, very low in the northwest.
Well,
I have not seen it myself, because I've got mountains in that direction. I don't have a good horizon in that direction.
Right. By when would you say it will be a good evening object?
It should start becoming fairly easily visible in the evening by the 22nd, 23rd of March or so, maybe a little before that.
The closest point to Earth will be how many miles?
122 million.
122 million miles.
Which is 1.3 times as far away as the sun is.
What would have happened if the comet had been, say, as close as Hayakutake came?
Oh, that was... would be wonderful. If the comet had actually been closest to the sun in early December instead of beginning of April, it would have come as close to the Earth as Comet Yakutake did around January 3rd of this year. And it would have been impressive, to say the very least, to make a major understatement. It would have definitely been certainly brighter than the planet Venus by far. And may have had a tail which stretched a good halfway all the way across the sky.
Oh, my goodness.
It would have been a stupendous sight.
Are we likely to get, it's impossible to say, I suppose, but are we likely to get another comet as neat as Hale-Bopp is right now in our lifetime?
It's possible. Great comets tend to come about once every 10 years or so on the average. We had Comet West in 1976, which was a beautiful object in the morning sky. And then we didn't really have anything for 20 years, and then Comet Yagutake came by a year ago. Although that was really more of an ordinary comet, which just happened to come very close to the Earth, and we were able to view the tail in such a way as to have a phenomenally long tail across the sky. But by my definition, that was certainly a great comet.
Okay, well, one of the things that I remember about that comet, and I try to follow these things from a layman's point of view, I found it very interesting. They said, ooh, surprise, surprise, Hayakutake is emitting X-rays. Why would a comet emit X-rays?
That is a good question. We really don't know for sure. That was a definite surprise. And we still, although, now let me make a disclaimer here. I'm not exactly an expert on all the different emissions and everything which come from comets, although I do know a fair amount about it. My understanding is we still don't really have a mechanism yet for what is causing the X-rays to be emitted. And for a while, it's thought we might just be seeing reflections of the sun's X-ray emission, which the sun does give off X-rays. We thought we might be seeing reflections. I understand that there's been some observations since then which kind of tend to refute that. One of the interesting things is that once the X-rays were found in Comet Yakutake, some researchers went back and looked through some old data taken by some of the X-ray satellites like Rosette and a couple of the others, and identified X-ray emission in some older comets which had been by over the past several years. But no one had really even thought to look for it.
So in other words, it's likely this is a regular occurrence, nothing specific to Hayakutake.
Right. And although I don't believe anyone's detected X-rays in Hale-Bopp yet, I don't think anyone's looked for it yet. I know there are proposals out there and plans to look for X-rays from Hale-Bopp when it gets a little bit closer.
All right, this may be out on a limb time here, but I'll ask you about it. There are a lot of people who have theories about an energy that is in space, here, all around us. They call it zero-point energy, and that an object traveling through space, a mass traveling through space, would interact with this energy, and could that be one explanation for a source of energy to produce the emission of X-rays?
Well, I'm not really sure I can comment on that because I'm not really familiar with the idea. I kind of tend to discount it. Would not the Earth do the same thing?
Yes.
Would not the sun produce energy because the sun itself is traveling through space?
Yes, I would think so.
Yeah. And, of course, we do know the sun gives off X-rays, but that's due to processes going on within its atmosphere, which causes that to happen.
Well, if it's a snowball and there's water and there's various things, it's just hard to imagine where X-rays would come from. They're a very short wavelength.
Yeah, it probably has to do with some of the ionization processes that are going on. Again, as these substances like the water, some of the other substances, kind of like carbon monoxide and these other volatiles that I was talking about, as they ionize, we may be seeing an ionization effect, but I'm just kind of speculating in the dark right here, so don't put too much
trust in that. Oh, that's fine. Look, this is the home of that. Feel free. What do you think of the idea of a space mission? We don't seem to have many space goals these days anymore.
Unfortunately.
That's right. I agree. To land on a comet.
I think it'd be fascinating. It has been investigated in some of the better science fiction novels I've read. I think it'd be fascinating to really get a first-hand look at what's going on some of these things and actually seeing these eruptions of material going on and what have you. I think it'd be fascinating. I mean, I've read a couple of science fiction novels where that theme has been addressed when Halley comes around again in the year 2061.
Could it be done?
It certainly could be. The question is do we have the willpower to do so?
The political will, that's and the money, that's an entirely different question.
Yes, it is.
Are you saddened, as I am, by the great pullback that we've made since the Apollo days?
I would certainly have to say that I am. Of course, I'm giving away a secret here, but I was 11 years old when Armstrong and Aldrin, it's early in the morning here, walked on the moon. And, of course, I was in the elementary school during the 60s. And, of course, this was after Sputnik, which kind of scared the pants off of the Americans.
Sure did.
And, of course, that kind of fed the whole Apollo project to begin with. And I remember watching the Gemini flights and the early Apollo flights. And, of course, I do remember very vividly watching the Apollo 11 mission on the black and white TV we had in Alamogordo at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I really had every reason to believe that I was looking at a preview of my own future. And I thought, you know, gee, when I'm those guys' age, I'm going to be, you know, off doing things far better than they were.
But it's like it skipped a generation.
Yeah, in fact, I am right now, I'm about a month or two older than Neil Armstrong was when he was walking on the moon. I've got about another month to go, and I'll catch up to the age that Buzz Aldrin was at when he was walking on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we're not there. I think it's been very frustrating. A major pullback in a lot of ways. Certainly science education, I think. The way science is being funded in this country. It's a large discussion here. It's a very deep subject, and there's certainly a lot of things. Of course, Apollo was not really science-driven. It was politically driven.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, it was driven by politics. Beat the Russians. I mean, that was the whole goal of Apollo, was beat the Russians. And we got a lot of tremendous good science from Apollo, but that was not the reason it was done.
There also was a news story in the last couple of days, just in case we do happen to go back to Mars, and we're making some attempts now, and collect samples, that those samples, on return, would have to be quarantined because they're worried about infection of Earth by some microbial agent from Mars. Is that a prudent thing to do?
I believe it is. It would seem unlikely, but again, it goes back to the fact that when we're talking about life, we have a sample of one to work with, and you can't do very good statistics from a sample of one. So we really have no idea how any potential life form that would arise in another environment would interact with the life forms we have here on Earth.
So it's prudent to be careful.
Right.
All right, Doctor, we're at the bottom of the hour, so we'll
talk
for a minute. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about that movie, Asteroid, and the research you've done on close Earth objects. This is CBC. As part of his bio, I noted earlier when I read it, it indicates he is also interested in the present efforts to identify potential Earth-impacting asteroids and comets, and is currently engaged in initiating a search program for these objects to be conducted from southern New Mexico, and which will include participation by school students and the general public. In other words, lots of eyes. And, Alan, did you happen to see the movie Asteroid? Alan, are you there? Hello, Alan. Oh, boy. I've lost Alan. Okay, well, I warned him at the beginning of the program that such a thing could occur. So, what I'm going to have to do is what I do when things like this happen is get him back on the line. So if you will all stand by a moment, we will retrieve Dr. Hale and be right back. I would think that they treat somebody with a last name like Bell better than they do me, but we got cut off. Anyway, I think we're back together again, Dr. Hale.
Yep.
Okay, good. I'm sure you missed what I said, which is a shame. What I was saying was that in your bio, you have begun a project looking for objects, comets, asteroids, that might impact with Earth, and you're getting school children and so forth in the American public involved in that. And I'm all for that. Did you see the movie Asteroid?
Yes, I did. I expected to get some questions about it, so I plunked myself down in front of the tube for a few hours and watched it.
Okay. So did I, and I thought, by the way, it started out, at least dramatically, very well. And by the time that movie was over, had I been there, I'd have stepped on that little kid's hands and let him drop into the crater. I was so angry at him. I mean, it's like he went on a straight beeline for the ground zero impact point. I was so angry. Anyway, obviously there are things out there that could impact Earth. We've had a few close calls, and I've been doing talk radio a long time, Doctor, and I remember several years ago hearing several reports about, guess what, folks? Scientists just announced that 2 days ago we had a very, very close call with an object. And we heard about it 2 days after it passed our orbit near Earth. What are the chances that in our lifetimes, something or another pretty big will hit Earth?
It depends on the size of the object. If you're talking something that's 10 meters, 15 meters, we've had two hits this century that we know of, both were in Siberia. If we're talking larger objects, say 100 meters or so, yeah, I'm pulling a number out of the air here, but perhaps sure, every few thousand years we'll have something like that, or maybe even a longer time scale than that. The object which made the meteor crater near Flagstaff, Arizona, was made about 49,000 years ago, and that was about 100 meters in diameter, at least that's what Gene Shoemaker tells me.
Mm.
If we're talking about big objects that are a few miles in diameter, ones that could really wipe us out as far as life forms here on the Earth, we're probably talking about something which happens over timescales of many millions of years, if not tens of millions of years. Now, the Cretaceous tertiary impact was 65 million years ago, and that seems to be the last really significant impact. So the chances of it, something like that happening in our lifetime, are probably very remote, but it's not zero.
All right. Let's say, for the sake of conversation, that we identified something.
Okay.
That was headed our way, as in the movie Asteroid. In the movie Asteroid, I was quite surprised. The first time they just let this sucker come in and do what it did to Kansas City, and then they finally decided to act when they saw the second big one. If something the size of that second one were headed toward us, would what they did be a viable alternative? That is, blowing it to smithereens, they thought.
Yeah, you're not going to blow it to smithereens. The best you could probably do is break it into a few larger, few smaller fragments, say a half dozen or so.
Mm-hmm.
What you do, I think, depends entirely on how much lead time you have. If we have some decent survey efforts going on, of which we're starting to initiate some now, we may very well have a 50 or 100-year warning.
Oh, really?
That's something. Once you identify an object and you calculate its orbit, you can compute its orbit for an indefinite period of time into the future.
All right. I've never been shot with a bullet, but I am told that when you are, you never hear the rifle shot from the bullet that hits you, and that asteroids might be a little bit like that, ones that are headed directly for you. Are they harder to see?
If something is coming directly towards you, yes, it would be pretty difficult to see, simply because the way we detect asteroids is we detect their motion against the background stars. If there's something coming directly at you, it's kind of hard to see that.
In other words, there is no relative horizontal motion.
There's not much to speak of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So the idea, of course, is you want to find them ahead of time before that really happens.
Plus, an asteroid is a big, just black rock, and space is black, and I know that may be oversimplified, or is it?
That's oversimplified because the moon is a fairly black object, but it does reflect sunlight.
It's true.
But I don't remember the exact percentage here, but I think it's something like, it's less than 10%, maybe as low as 4% of the light that, the sunlight that goes on the moon. The moon is still a bright object in our sky.
You know something about our space program. If there were an object out there, and let's say we had weeks of warning, several weeks of warning might be reasonable, and it occurred right now. Today we found it.
Mm-hmm.
Would we be able to do anything significant about it?
Probably not. If you had years of warning, you could go out and perhaps stick a little rocket engine on the thing and give it a bit of a nudge. If you give it a bit of a nudge now, 50 years from now, that nudge makes a big difference. On the other hand, you have a few weeks of warning, there's probably not much you can do. Theoretically, you could maybe launch a few nuclear warheads at the thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen is you're going to break it into a few smaller fragments. So you have a choice. You have one real big object coming at you. Do you want a half dozen smaller ones coming at you?
Is there Is there a big difference? In other words, would one larger object be a total planet killer? If you divided that into six objects, then are you better off? Or does it just take out more cities on more continents?
A large object hitting you, say, you know, 6 mile across object, would probably be a planet killer, at least in terms of the significant life forms on the planet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A smaller object that we're talking about may wreak havoc over part of a continent, as it were. So you'd have, say, a half dozen hits, some of them which would be in water, which would create tidal waves and wipe out a few coastal areas and coastal cities.
So if we had an object a few weeks out right now, and you were the one in charge of what to do about it, what would you do?
Oh, well, you're going to put that responsibility on my shoulders.
Sure.
Well, if I had the ability to do that, I would probably opt to go ahead and try to break it into smaller fragments. At least it would have some survival that way, I think, whereas you'd have almost a certain planet-wide catastrophe if the whole object hit as one piece.
So if you discount the last ugly, dramatic half of that movie, the premise of the movie wasn't all that far off then?
In some respects, no, because the threat is there. On the other hand, the way the asteroids got here, the comet perturbing their orbits, that's completely absurd.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah. A comet does not have enough mass to do anything like that. A comet's kind of been described one way as about as close to nothing as you can get and still be something. I mean, the mass that these things have is almost negligible.
Well, let's try the question the other way around, though. It does, the orbit of the comet does become influenced by planets and suns and so forth, does it not?
Yeah. I mean, Hale-Bopp's orbit was changed somewhat when it came by Jupiter a year ago. So, yes, the planets, gravity does affect the comets.
Is there a chance that the orbit of a comet Hale-Bopp or some other large comet could be perturbed in an annoying way from our point of view?
By one of the large planets, yes, and it's certainly possible. Look what happened with Shoemaker-Levy 9 and Jupiter.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. All right, a number of questions for you by fax, and then we'll get to the phones at the top of the hour. At what speed is Hale-Bopp traveling?
You know, I get that question all the time, and I never really sit and bother to try to figure that out. The speed will change depending on where it is in its orbit. The closer it gets to the sun, the faster it's moving. The further away from it is, the slower it's moving.
Huh.
Right now, it is slightly beyond the Earth's distance from the sun, so it's moving at slightly less than the Earth's orbital velocity. But the Earth is moving at 18 miles a second in its orbit around the sun, if I remember the numbers correctly. So right now, I'd put the figure for Hale-Bopp at 12 to 15 miles a second. That's a number I'm pulling out of the air.
Oh, that's really fast.
When it's closest to the sun at the beginning of April, that will increase to, I believe, 26 miles per second.
Mm.
And it'll start to slow down again.
Are there any estimates on how much mass Hale-Bopp is losing per unit of time?
Oh, I've seen some of those, and offhand, off the top of my head, I don't have those. It's in the number of several tons per second.
Several tons.
I believe it. Don't quote me on that. It's somewhere around that. Of course, but by our standards, you know, you just heard me say that a comet's as close to nothing as you can get and still be something. That's on a planetary standard. By our own standards, a comet is still a massive object, certainly something like that. So it can lose figures like that and still lose a very tiny percentage of its mass.
Oh, so as it goes round and round,
mm-hmm.
Eventually, if it is all ice, someday it'll just be gone, or is there a core to it?
No, that pretty much is the core. There's ice, there's dust, there's organic materials and all sorts of junk. It's kind of a mixture of all this junk going through space. But yes, every time a comet goes around the sun, it loses its material, loses some of it, which never comes back to it. So you give a comet going around the sun enough times, and eventually it loses all its volatiles, and it disintegrates. We've seen this happen several times. In fact, it happened rather dramatically with a comet that appeared last fall. And we saw this comet come in. It actually came bright enough to be visible to the naked eye briefly, but apparently it was a very tiny object, and as it came around the sun, just disintegrated.
That was it. It got used up, and
yeah.
Huh.
There was nothing left. Once it came back from around the sun, there was nothing there.
All right. There have been reports of radio emissions. And I'm not now talking about the unambiguous intelligent signals that one's said to be coming from it. I'm talking about, in the spectrum, certain radio emissions. Is that accurate? Have you heard that?
Yes. And almost all objects in space emit radio waves. The sun, Jupiter, numerous stars, and so on. And comets as well. In fact, as the comet's getting closer to the sun and starts to feel sun's heat, we have some physical and chemical activity going on, and some of the emissions that we see are actually in the radio part of the spectrum. In fact, it was observations in that part of the spectrum which were the first indications we had that it was carbon monoxide that was giving and producing the activity. We detected carbon monoxide lines in the radio part of the spectrum.
Can you tell us what part of the radio spectrum those emissions were most easily observed in?
Oh, boy, I don't have that off the top of my head. I believe it was in what we would almost call the microwave part of the spectrum. If any of my astronomy friends are hearing me, they might be groaning because I just honestly don't have that information in my head right now. But it's somewhere, I think, in a neighborhood of a few gigahertz.
Okay, I was going to guess at 2-plus gigahertz somewhere.
It's somewhere in that ballpark, I believe.
Mm-hmm. All right. So your forecast for this comet, and this surprised me when we talked the other day. I had thought that around April 1st, at the latest, it would be at its brightest. But that is not necessarily so. And the truth is, you said, it could continue to brighten through April. Is that right?
Through part of April. My feeling is its brightest will probably be right at near the very beginning of April. It may start to fade slowly, although, who knows, again, these comets do weird things from time to time. But the tail development will probably be better towards the middle of April. I mean, I'm kind of assuming here the comet's going to behave like a typical comet, and that, of course, gets dangerous after a while. But the comet should be a brilliant object at least through the end of April, at least, and will actually still be bright, although fading by May and June still. But,
all right, we will not pass, or will we, through the orbit of Hale-Bopp?
No. The comet is it's in orbit. It's almost perpendicular to the Earth's orbit, and it's well above the Earth's orbit right now. It will pass through the plane of the Earth's orbit in early May, and that is a point outside the Earth's orbit, and we're quite a ways away from it at that time. Again, if the comet had been closest to the sun in early December, we'd be at those respective close points at the same time, but that's the way it goes.
Would there be, if we pass through its tail, or in the tail of any comet, would there be a resultant meteor shower or a shower of any sort?
Probably not. The tail is very, very thin, and we would probably not see much of anything there. We have passed through comet tails from time to time through history. I don't think we've had any unusual effects. But now, this dust that is being blown off tends to follow the comet in its orbit, and if we intersect that orbit from time to time, we do see meteor showers. There's the famous Perseid meteor shower we encounter every August,
right?
Which is due to a comet that comes by every 130 years or so. And that's just dust grains that have been ejected, and then they just fall around the comet's orbit. There's the famous Leonid meteor shower, which is associated with a comet that returns every 33 years, and this seems to be a very tight clump, a swarm of dust that follows the comet by a year or two. The comet was last around in 1965. We had a tremendous meteor shower the following year. And that comet is due back in 1998. We may have another very tremendous shower in November of 1999, or possibly 98, possibly 99, possibly not at all, but we'll have to wait and see.
All right, here's another one for you. We talked about an impact on Earth of a comet or an asteroid. What about something that just is a real close miss, and by close I mean something that wouldn't hit the Earth but would in effect just go knifing right through its atmosphere?
Okay.
What would happen?
We actually had an occurrence of that in the early 1970s. The object was probably about 5 meters in diameter, which isn't all that big, really. Seems to have entered the Earth's atmosphere at a very shallow angle, kind of was passing south and north over the western United States. It got to within about 60 miles of the Earth's surface, I believe over Montana.
And I think they've got some video of that.
Oh, yeah, there's some dramatic video of that. This was in the middle of the afternoon. It was apparently a brilliant object. and then just kind of scooted on back into space.
Mm.
It didn't do anything to the Earth other than turn some people's attention toward this thing.
What about something, say, a mile or so wide? Doing the same thing, or something the size of Hale-Bopp doing that?
Oh, boy. That's an interesting question. I'm not sure I can give the best answer to that. Certainly something past, let's say Hale-Bopp's 25 miles an hour diameter, let's work that figure, and it passes 60 miles from the Earth, it would probably create a lot of heat, a lot of friction, and could produce a few forest fires over good parts of the Earth. It would not be the complete devastation that we had, say, with the Great Cretaceous Tertiary impact. But there would definitely be some effects, at least in the area under which it passed.
We would regard it as a bad day.
We'd regard a bad day, especially if you were in the area under which it passed. You'd probably be holding your breath, because I'm not sure we'd be able to predict its path that accurately ahead of time. We would certainly be seeing this as a possibility of an impact, and would hold our breath, seeing if it really did or not.
By the way, and this has got to be a quick answer because we're at the top of the hour, but in the movie Asteroid, they predicted that it was going to whack Kansas City. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, they can't even properly predict when satellites are where they're going to impact, and they missed that by continent size margins. Was that unrealistic that it would hit Kansas City?
I think we'd be able to say, be able to identify a hemisphere.
All right. Very good. A hemisphere. All right. We'll be right back. Dr. Alan Hale is my guest. Stay right there. Mexico, generally pretty good a viewing country for Hale-Bopp, and it occurred to me, Doctor, the one thing I haven't asked you yet is a good layman's explanation for everybody out there of how to go find Hale-Bopp in the morning.
Okay. That's actually pretty easy. What you do is around 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, let's pick 4:30, good round even time, you go out, look in the northeast, somewhat above the horizon in the northeast, and you don't have to do anything else. You will see it.
Yeah.
It is the brightest, just about the brightest object in the entire sky right now. I think Mars may be brighter and Jupiter's brighter. And that's about it. And you cannot miss it.
That's right. It is a very serious item. How do you think that the present brightness in the morning sky will compare to the best moment in the evening sky when it moves?
If it continues to behave itself, that is an if, it should still be quite a bit brighter when we see it in the evening toward the end of this month and early April than it is right now. We still have quite a ways to go.
Wow. People are never going to forget this. And you, and just let me, then we'll go to the phones. Let me ask you about that. You are forevermore going to be associated with this comet and known by this comet. How do you feel about that?
It's an interesting feeling. Of course, I kind of got the approach that I still have a life to work with and
exactly.
live for the next several years.
Yes.
And then some of the work I do that, you know, with the Southwest Institute and everything.
I assume on balance, though, it is an advantage.
Oh, certainly. I guess one of the neatest impressions for me is that we know from studying the comet's orbit that it will be back in about 2,400 years.
2,400 years.
And which means if you want to see it, you better see it now. It's a long wait before you get a chance to see it again.
Any idea how many times she's been around?
At least once.
At least once.
Yeah, and that was about 4,200 years ago, and the reason that's different from the 2,400 figure I just gave you is I mentioned a little while earlier that it passed close to Jupiter last year and on its way in, and that shortened its orbit period somewhat.
Are we able to predict where it will cross next time?
It will come in on pretty much the same orbit that it came in this time, so somebody looking in 2,400 years now should be able to find it somewhere coming up from Sagittarius.
Oh. All right. Well, I could go on asking questions forever, but I'm not going to. I'm going to turn it to the audience. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Alan Hale. Where are you, please?
Hi, I'm Bob, Minneapolis. And
hello.
Good morning, Art. Morning,
hi.
Dr. Hale.
Good morning.
I have an interest in comets, and I'd like to ask you a question, basically, a little about cometary theory. Did the impact of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 into Jupiter last year, the many pieces that were all strung out, would that be a result of a single nucleus being broken up by the gravitational forces on its previous orbit, or could that possibly be a demonstration of Thomas Van Flandern's theory that the nucleuses may be composed of many pieces that are all gravitationally attracted to each other?
Oh, good question.
I'm not extremely familiar with the Van Flandern idea. I think that's a fairly old one, which at least some of the more recent observations seem to have thrown out, specifically the Giotto flyby of Halley back in the mid-1980s. The feeling about Shoemaker-Levy 9 is that this was a single object. It has been in orbit around Jupiter since the early 1920s, and I'm kind of pulling these years out of the top of my head here. And on its previous close approach to Jupiter in July of 1992, it passed close enough to Jupiter that the tidal effects resulting from Jupiter's gravity were, in fact, able to rip it into the several pieces that we saw when the comet was discovered about a year later.
Okay, so then you don't subscribe to the Van Flandern model, which suggests that a comet is made up of a lot of little pieces orbiting together.
I think at this point the evidence seems to argue against that. Again, we have not seen much in the way of cometary nuclei. I guess the closest we have, again, the Giotto flyby of Halley and the other spacecraft 11 years ago, and also when Comet Hyakutake came by the Earth a year ago, to my knowledge, there was only one signal that came back from the Goldstone and radar bounce experiment.
Good answer. Anything else, caller?
No, I'd just like to say that for all the listeners, get out and see this comet. It's one of the most spectacular sights you'll ever see, other than maybe a total solar eclipse. Those two have to be the best.
Good for you.
If you're in Mongolia about this time, in about 20 hours from now, you will get to see both.
Wow. I also understand that in the middle of March, there will be a nearly full lunar eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
Will that be an interesting time to view the comet?
Yes, it will. That's on the night of the 23rd.
The 23rd?
Yeah, and the comet will be in the evening sky, although fairly low. But we'll have an almost total eclipse of the moon. Not quite. It'll be very deep partial. And yes, full moons have a tendency to wipe out objects like comet tails.
Right.
Everything. But here we'll get a brief respite while the moon is in eclipse.
So it'll be a doubly good reason to go out and take a look-see.
Right.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Alan Hale. Hello, where are you, please?
Thank you. Mr. Bell, this is Robert. I'm in the San Joaquin Valley, California.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Hale, it's a pleasure, extreme honor to meet you, sir.
Thank you.
A man of history.
True.
Ordinary guy. But
yeah. Well, sir, before I... ask my one question that I feel is an important question. Hopefully you can help us with it. I just want to quickly say, Mr. Bell, that I found out today that all of Japan, for the past 2 weeks, they have been very excited. The news is not telling us here in the U.S. that they found, I don't know if it's a city, 260 miles of roads over in Okinawa. You might want to check into that.
They found what, please?
They said that below the sea, off of Okinawa...
I've been hearing rumors of this for some time, and I think there was a guest on Laura Lee's show that was talking about this, and I spent a decade of my life on the island of Okinawa,
yes, sir,
so
I know.
I'll be looking into it. Anyway, your question?
Yes, Doctor, with the recent addition to Hubble, I heard on news releases that they are viewing Hale Bopp. Do you have any information as to what actually is going on through Hubble?
All right, yes, that is a good question. The new additions to Hubble, apparently better vision, able to look at different parts of the light spectrum, or I really don't know.
Specifically the infrared.
Infrared, okay.
Yeah, that's the main installation infrared camera. I'm not directly affiliated with Hubble, but my understanding is that there's a certain shakedown period to test the new instruments, make sure that everything's functioning normally, you know, that there are no serious problems have developed from installing the new instruments. And I presume, although I'm not really in the know right here, that we're still in the middle of that shakedown period. As far as observing Hale Bopp with Hubble is concerned right now, we have a problem in that you don't want to take a chance on pointing this expensive high-tech equipment at the sun and burning out all your detectors, because you would do that immediately if it even got close to the sun. So there are constraints on how close can we point to this instrument to the sun that we don't want to take a chance of getting anything closer. And that figure, as I understand it, is 50 degrees. And unfortunately, Hale-Bopp is within 50 degrees of the sun right now. In fact, has been for 3 or 4 months and will continue to be within that 50-degree forbidden zone, as it were, for another several months, and does not leave that until later this year.
So when Hale-Bopp is close, we are not going to be able to point to Hubble at it.
Right.
Oh, that is sad.
It is. It would be great. Of course, we got some interesting images of the comet coming in with Hubble, and I'm sure, although I guess I can't speak for the scientists who are actually going to be putting for time on this, but I'm quite sure they're going to be observing it as it recedes.
Let me ask you, Doctor, about a rumor that's out there that after your discovery of Hale-Bopp, along with Tom Bopp, and I've got to ask about Tom Bopp, that people went back and looked at some old plates and found Hale-Bopp from a deep space photography done by large telescopes long ago. Is there anything to that?
Yes. Once we had a decent orbit for the comet, it was actually a simple procedure when we knew where the comet was at past times, and one image of the comet was identified on a photograph taken with a telescope at Siding Spring Observatory, New South Wales, Australia, in April 1993, when it was well beyond the orbit of Saturn. And I've seen that image. In fact, I reproduced that image in the book.
Oh.
And it's clearly a comet. It's definitely a fuzzy object thing there. It's clearly there.
So what's the answer? They just didn't notice?
Right. If you take one of these large photographs of a fairly wide field of the sky, covering quite a bit of area, and there's fuzzy objects all over it, galaxies, and so on. Now, a comet can be noticed because during, say, a 50-minute exposure, it moves and it's trailed. The image is trailed. Well, Hale-Bopp was so far out at that time that the trailing was negligible. If you look at the image very carefully, you'll see that it is trailed. But someone who was looking for a trail of a comet will be looking for something a lot longer than this.
Fair enough.
So possibly someone did see it, but passed it off as one of the 2,000 other galaxies which show up on that same photograph.
So they could have been the discoverer, but they weren't.
Theoretically.
All right. In the media, you're fairly prominent, Dr. Hale. Tom Bopp, on the other hand, is not. I mean, Bopp is almost like a mythical character who is never seen and never heard. Is there really a Mr. Bopp?
He's an incredibly nice guy. He's very nice. I had not heard of Tom. I don't know if he'd heard of me or not prior to that infamous night.
Uh-huh.
Tom is an amateur astronomer who works and lives around Phoenix and was out with a few of his friends when he found the same little fuzzy object that I did at around the same time. And we've gotten to know each other. We've met on a few occasions. We've done a few joint appearances, and he has done a few speaking engagements on his own. He's a quieter guy than I am. He knows how to keep his mouth shut, whereas I don't. but he's an incredibly nice guy, and is helping with this world pedestal that we're both being put on for a while.
It really is going to be a kind of an interesting couple of months for you now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think even though the media at a gigantic level has not yet grasped this, they're about to.
Yeah, they're in the process of doing that right now. I'm getting, like I say, quite a few interviews. I give 3 or 4 interviews a day right now.
Really?
And I'm getting, the phone does not stop ringing, and it's only going to keep getting more and more interesting.
All right, well, you haven't done it, so I'm going to make you do it. You have authored a book about this comet, and
yes.
I think it's called Everybody's Comet?
Yes, it is.
And tell us a little about the book.
Okay, it's... Of course, I had to capitalize on this name, like anyone. The next section is, where do I look, how do I look, when do I look, and so on.
Sure.
So that's the thing that I think most people are probably interested in. I have a brief afterword where I talk about my own personal view of this thing, what this has meant to me, what I'd like to do with this. Again, that's a very personal thing. And then I've got a few appendices, various other sources of information, a timeline. I had to use a few technical terms throughout the course of the book, although I tried to use those as little as I could. I do have a glossary which explains anything out of the ordinary. And an appendix about some of the work I'm doing at the Southwest Institute for Space Research, or at least what I'd like to do.
All right. Where is your book available? How do they get it?
Okay, it should be available in bookstores. I know Barnes & Noble is carrying it nationwide.
All right.
I think some of the other chain bookstores are as well. I know, because I know I've done a couple book sightings at a couple of these other places. It is directly available from the publisher. That's High Lonesome Books in Silver City, New Mexico. They have a 1-800 number.
All right, go ahead. Let's hear it.
1-800-380-7323. That's off the top of my head. I'm about 98% certain that that's correct.
Oh, boy, it better be correct.
Well, I can go double-check real quick.
At the bottom of the hour break here, you better check.
I can do that right now while we're talking, so.
All right. You know, you sort of stopped when you got toward the end there, and you said, I wrote about what this comet means to me. So that sounds like an awfully good question. Phones, I'm coming to you in a second. Hold tight. The question is, Doctor, you know, on a personal level,
mm-hmm.
what does this mean to you?
It's given me a chance to actually make a career out of science, I guess, if I could put it in a nutshell. I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, that I was one of those who was inspired by Apollo and so on to go pursue a career in science, and there were quite a few of us in our generation that were inspired to do just that. And so we went through all the rigors of college and majoring in one of the sciences and going through graduate school. And let me tell you, graduate school is no picnic. It's definitely a lot of work.
If this turns out to be your legacy,
mm-hmm.
and we'll all end up with some sort of legacy, whatever we're remembered for, it wouldn't be that bad, would it?
No, it would not. Certainly getting my name on something like this. Of course, I'm still approaching this with the idea that I've got the... I'd like to think another 30 or 40 years of my life left.
And there's other comets out there.
Yeah. Well, I've got something I want to do. I formed this organization, the Southwest Institute for Space Research, about 3.5 years ago for the very pragmatic reason that there are no jobs for scientists these days. And in fact, I really can't encourage any student to pursue a career in science because the employment prospects are so bad.
Oh, that's awful.
It is. And... a lot of us, again, were inspired by Apollo, but as you pointed out, there's been this major cutback.
Sure.
A step backwards, kind of, as I look at it. Yet in a society that is more dependent upon science with each passing year, when you get right down to it, with all the new technology and everything that is coming out, and people who don't really understand how science operates. And so I think it's all been tied up in the fact that there's very little work for a person that goes to college and wants to contribute to our knowledge about the universe. So, and it's not just astronomy, it's a lot of science.
Well, here, let me tell you my situation. I've been in electronics microwave all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I began with electronics, those were the days when you sat down and you built your own gear, and you went out and you bought parts and you designed something, or you took somebody's circuit and put it together. Those days are long gone,
mm-hmm.
and I'm long lost in terms of present-day state-of-the-art electronics, and most people are. In other words, we're down to black-box technology. If something goes wrong, you either throw it away or pull a module, if it's worth enough, and replace a module, but you don't understand how you fixed it. And that seems to have been what's happened to science. There's very little room anymore for the layman. It's very, very specialized. Is that occurring across the spectrum?
Somewhat. I mean, I can only offer a perspective on astronomy, I guess. Astronomy is actually one place where the amateur, as it were, can make contributions. I mean, we do have CCDs available these days, and there are actually quite a few amateur astronomers are making quite a few good contributions and discoveries. I can't really speak for some of the other sciences.
So you would encourage somebody to become an amateur astronomer, but not necessarily to pursue a full career in science?
I would love to be able to do that, but with the employment prospects currently being what they are, no, I cannot.
God, that's sad.
Yeah. So that's kind of why I went and formed this organization. I wanted to have a career in science, and by golly, I'm going to have one way or another.
Well, so in a lot of ways, you've got a lot to thank this comet for.
Absolutely.
All right, hold on. And I promise we'll lay into the phones when we get back. So if you have a question for Dr. Alan Hale, co-discoverer of this incredible comet, coursing through the cold space above us, come now. Trooper, I know it's an hour later there, so it's going to be Pretty late. Are you normally a night? I would guess you're a night person.
Yeah, a spacey guys have to be, I think.
That's right. That's the time that you've got to be out working. So, what do you generally, when you have the time, are you generally up into the middle of the night?
Usually, I usually work better that way anyway. But of course, I'm up in the day a lot too. That's when I interact with the rest of society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I spend a lot of time in front of a computer, so.
Very much like my life, actually. All right, east of the Rockies, I promised. To the phones, you're on the air with Dr. Alan Hale. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Mark from Collinsville, Illinois, on SETCOM.
Hello, Mark.
Hello, Art. I just came in from the outdoors, set my binoculars up, so excuse my shaking. It's very cold outside.
Oh, it is, yes.
I let my binoculars adjust. Mr. Hale, I have a few quick comments. Or, in fact, one comment and several quick questions, if I may. With no disrespect to your discovery, Mr. Hale, I would like to suggest to you that this comet has already been named from its possible appearance in the middle of the second millennium B.C.
Well, with no disrespect intended, I'm sure he is Dr. Hale.
Dr. Hale, yes. And there were many worldwide accounts of a great comet that fits the description and orbit of Hale-Bopp. I would advise everybody to, or challenge everybody to do their homework. All you got to do is go to B. Dalton, in fact. And another question. Could you explain...
Well, no, wait a minute. Let him respond to that. You're saying that it's no new deal.
Well, it's been out here since 1950.
All right. Doctor?
Would you care to cite the source of this?
Well, Emmanuel Velikovsky, for one.
Okay, I have a tendency to discount the works of Velikovsky. He had a lot of ideas which have since been shown to have been unverified. The idea that, for example, I think he was, that Jupiter emits comets.
Well, yes, I agree with that. But his accounts from the middle of the second millennium are not myths. They're actually oral traditions and rock art and whatnot of a worldwide catastrophe. And, descriptions of, horse hair, the raging bull, which this comet has got the two horns, and there's descriptions of it rising from the east and growing bright and heading north. But I would suggest everybody to look into it. And my other question is, could you explain why NASA has cut off pictures from Hubble since October of 95?
Well, he just explained that. Did you not, Doctor?
Yes. In fact, there's Hubble images from as recently as October 1996.
What about the work of Sitchin, Zacharias Sitchin? Any comments?
I'd be truthful, I have not read it, but I have read critiques of some of his work, and I have a tendency to disbelieve that type of thing. I don't really necessarily see the evidence there. Again, I've not necessarily read the work, but again, I've read critiques of it. Maybe I shouldn't.
All right.
Overblow that too much. As far as a previous return of Hale-Bopp, yes, we do know that it was around once before. Unless there's a specific amount of positional information which can identify an object as this comet, there are lots of comets. Comets with two tails happens all the time. Almost every comet that comes close to the sun develops two tails. So that is really nothing unusual.
And we don't have the name of the guy who might have seen it the last time it was around.
And the tradition, the tradition of naming comets for the discoverers goes back two centuries, not millennia.
Yes.
The orbit we have tells us that Hale-Bopp was around 4,200 years ago. My understanding is that there has been one record of a comet from the year, I believe, 2192 B.C., but that there's not enough information, at least at this point, to tell us whether or not that's a record of Hale-Bopp or whether it's a record of one of the other great comets that certainly must have been around at that time.
All right, Doctor. I would be remiss if I did not ask you the following question, and that is, you spend a lot of time looking at the sky. A lot of people don't. They look straight ahead. They drive. They don't look at the sky, so they don't see things. But you're a guy who's looked at the sky for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a UFO flap going on in this country since Roswell or before. And with all the time that you have looked at the sky, have you ever seen anything that you just flat couldn't explain?
No.
No.
I've seen a lot of very interesting phenomena. Just a couple of mornings ago, I was actually looking at Hale-Bopp. And over in, which was in the northwest, northeast, and over in the northwest, there was this brilliant spear of light coming up from the horizon, disappearing into the sky and leaving a large trail of material behind it,
mm-hmm.
which got all twisted and everything. It was a rocket launch from White Sands Missile Range, which is not too far from me.
Yes, we see something just like that from Vandenberg here.
And I've seen things from Vandenberg when I lived out in California. But I've seen that. I've seen brilliant fireballs, which leave trails, which then get distorted by atmospheric winds. I've seen lithium and barium ionization experiments conducted in the atmosphere.
Sure.
Re-entering satellites.
Sure.
Auroras. We had an aurora here a few years ago. It was like the whole northern part of the sky is on fire, and I realize that the listeners that live in the more northern latitudes go aurora, big deal.
Yeah, I know. They know all about it. I lived in Anchorage. I saw you see it. It is a big deal, actually. It's beautiful.
Here in New Mexico, we get them once every few years, and it was very impressive. We had people calling in UFOs when they saw this aurora. I've seen a lot of these very fascinating natural and man-made phenomena, but I've never seen anything that I couldn't explain.
Couldn't explain. All right. Now a pretty sensitive question. You're a very mainstream kind of guy. Now you've discovered a comet that goes by your name forevermore. Very mainstream. If you saw something, honest answer call for here,
mm-hmm.
that you absolutely couldn't explain, would you report it? Would you think real hard before you reported it from a career point of view?
I would certainly report it. There was something that I could not explain. I mean, I have what I'd like to think is a fair amount of knowledge about the universe around me, but I certainly don't know everything. And science as a whole does not know everything, doesn't even come close to knowing everything. There's certainly
right.
a lot of things that we don't understand.
Right.
So I would certainly report it to my fellow astronomers and let them know, hey, I saw something. What do you think of this? And it would depend on whether it was a one-time event. If it was just a one-time event that never was repeated, I would kind of have a tendency to distrust my own senses.
There you are. That's I guess, what I meant. And though you thought you saw it, or even if you were sure you saw it, mm-hmm. if it wasn't repeatable and demonstrable, it would be career-threatening, would it not, to report it?
I don't think it would be career-threatening. I mean, the way I approach things is I know that our senses can sometimes deceive us. There have been times when I have been almost sleepy and I've almost felt detached from my own body, and yet it's just a state of, you know, I have like three-fourths of sleep and my consciousness starting to
sure.
slip away from me a little bit.
Sure.
And, you know, we can be deceived by our own senses. We can be deceived by our own preconceived notions from time to time. I guess it would depend upon the situation. I mean, if I actually had photographs of the thing and some sort of records which I could show to someone else, I would certainly feel no hesitation at all about calling up some of my astronomer colleagues.
Oh, that's good. Physical
and,
evidence.
What do you think about this? I mean,
sure.
I saw this.
Sure.
I'm not quite sure what to make of it. What do you think?
Okay. All right. Fair answer. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Alan Hale. Where are you, please?
I'm in Sacramento.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I appreciate this, Dr. Hale. I wanted to double check with you. That was the Southwest Institute for Scientific Research.
For space research.
For space research.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a web page involved?
We are just putting one together. I actually have a colleague of mine in Memphis who has put up a very temporary one. It's very much under construction right now.
Okay.
But I will certainly give you the URL for that.
Oh, yes, by all means. Okay. Go right ahead.
That's http://, just like all web addresses are.
Yes.
www.spaceportmemphis, all together, no breaks or anything, .com.
Spaceport Memphis?
Yeah, it's a colleague of mine that found a host in Memphis. And we'll be moving that to New Mexico, presumably at some point in time, the not-too-distant future. But meanwhile, you find a host when you can.
Okay. Are you taking now regular photographs of Hale Bob?
The only thing I'm doing to take photographs of Hale Bob is I'm sticking a 35-millimeter camera on a tripod and opening up the shutter.
Really?
For 30 or 40 seconds.
Really?
And you can get some gorgeous pictures that way if you have a bright enough comet.
Uh-huh. Instead of, and see, I went out and bought this camera attachment for my Mead, and I've been so disappointed in what I saw in the Mead, that, that's a very, very good idea. So you say a regular 35, what speed film?
Pretty fast. I've been using 400 or 1,000.
400 or 1,000, yeah. And how long an exposure?
30 or 40 seconds. You start getting much longer than that, you start to get trailing.
Okay.
And you don't want to do that.
All right. Well, that's a really good tip. All right. First,
if I may, in my book, I've got some examples of some comet photographs I've taken that way.
Okay.
And in fact, I have a lovely picture of Comet Yakutake that I managed to take the night it came by the North Pole a year ago. But I was able to get away with a 5-minute exposure without trailing, but that's kind of unusual.
Wow. Depends, I guess, on the state of the atmosphere.
And it depends really on how far north it is. Hale-Bopp is far enough north, we might be able to start getting away with maybe full-minute exposures without getting trailing, but with the setup I just described. So.
All right. Well, I'm out about 65 miles east of Las Vegas, a little town called Pahrump, Nevada, where we have very, very clear skies. Frankly, more so to the west than the east. Toward the east, we've got a bit of a glow from the city of Las Vegas, even that far away. But the skies out here are remarkable, and when it comes up in the west, I'm going to try exactly what you just suggested. Okay, first time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Alan Hale.
Hello, Art.
Hi.
Hi, I'm calling from Prince George, BC, Canada.
Yes, sir.
And we're getting a really nice view of this comet up here. Like, it's about an inch long in the sky to the naked eye.
Would the view that far north, Doctor, be any different?
It would be higher in the sky, and from that latitude, I believe it may be circumpolar now. It may not set. May stay above the horizon all night. My caller might be able to tell me that.
Can you see it all night long?
No, it comes up about 3:30, and then it's gone about 6.
Yeah. Within a week or so, you will be able to see it all night long.
Right on.
All right. Well,
be far in the north, along the northern horizon, but you will be able to see it.
All right. Well, if we have the time, we would attract some calls from Fairbanks. That's way up north. I presume they would be able to see it all the night long.
Mm-hmm.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Alan Hale. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning, Art. Jack from the Oregon coast. I'm in Fogsville, unfortunately.
Yep.
And good evening, or good morning, I guess, is Dr. Hale.
Good morning.
Yeah. Are you? Are you related in any way to Hale's observatory?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's a good question.
Okay.
I've never really investigated that.
Okay. Well, the one thing I did want to ask you, though, is only I had one question for you. My mother, she's long dead now, but when she was a little girl, I guess it was, back in, somewhere between 1908 and 1915, she remembers seeing Halley's Comet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm about right on the date because she was hearsay for me. And she said it was phenomenal back then.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that, or would you say that it's anything like this the Hale-Bopp comet?
Yeah, that's a fair question. A comparison between Halley's then and Hale-Bopp now.
Okay. If you were to look at the two comets under identical circumstances, Hale-Bopp is far and away larger and brighter of the two. But, of course, we have different circumstances. Where is the comet in relationship to the sun and the earth when it's closest and all that? It is possible that your mother might have been referring to another brilliant comet that appeared in 1910 called the Daylight Comet of 1910. It was visible during the day for a while.
Oh, my.
On the other hand, Halley was very well placed in 1910 and there was a period of time when it came fairly close to the earth, and our viewing geometry was such that the tail stretched a significant distance across the sky and at least put on a very good show for at least a brief period of time around that time.
So a comet could be bright enough to be visible during the day.
In fact, I have seen Hale-Bopp telescopically after sunrise.
I began to wonder about that the other morning myself. It was so bright.
Yeah.
That you would think, I mean, it's not as bright as Venus, but it's getting there.
It's bright enough to see, at least telescopically, after sunrise. I don't know if it's going to get bright enough to see the naked eye during daylight, but there have been occasional comets that have gotten that bright, although it's usually been for a brief period of time.
All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Alan Hale. Hi.
It's a very pleasure to be on the air.
Where are you, sir?
I am in Leavenworth, Kansas.
All right. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, what I'm doing is getting rid of my radio.
Okay, that's good.
You got to turn it completely off, correct?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Okay.
Very good.
So, Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Isn't that a great discovery that you discovered out there?
Objective question. Yes, it is.
I certainly consider it great from my own personal perspective. On the great grand scheme of things, perhaps not, but it's certainly one that's getting a lot of attention right now, and I am very glad of that.
Well, I was able to observe it yesterday morning, just before sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the eastern, southern part of the sky.
Southern? It should really be more than the north.
Well, from where I was at, where I looked at it, it was just above the horizon.
Okay.
Is that the correct place to look?
By sunrise, it's actually quite a ways above the horizon.
No. I'm just trying to say that I saw it, and I know that that was Hellbop.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
I'm pretty sure.
did it have a long tail with it?
Yes, sir.
Well, good chance it was, then. There's nothing else, Doctor, is there, in our sky right now with a long tail?
Nothing with a long tail. I mean, there's a couple of the planets that are fairly bright. Jupiter's kind of low in the southeast right now during dawn, and that's bright, and Mars is over in the west at that time. But and Hale-Bopp is in the northeast. Of course, the two planets are just points of light, at least to the eye they are.
May I ask about, we're so low on time now, but I want to ask about this. Venus, of course, is very bright.
Mm-hmm.
Morning sky Venus, or evening, if you look at it and just stare at Venus with your eyes, there is an optical thing that begins to occur. And Venus looks very much like it's moving up and down, sideways, and all over the place. And it's some sort of optical conclusion, I guess. That what is it that does that?
Good question. I haven't encountered that. It's probably just your eye, whether you know it or not, the eyelid is constantly blinking at a very fast rate.
Right, that's true.
And that's probably what you're seeing. The eye is not an analog sampler, your eye is a digital sampler.
Huh.
It samples things at a very phenomenal rate.
Yeah. So in other words,
you're probably seeing something associated with that. Maybe just your eyes getting tired of staring at this object.
Sure.
The whole time.
So that may account for the many reports of that being a UFO.
Yeah, in fact, Venus is probably the most commonly reported UFO of any object.
Uh-huh. You did acknowledge earlier in the program that there's a great likelihood that life is fairly common out there.
Mm-hmm.
Are you surprised that we have not yet encountered some serious evidence of that life in the form of radio signals, or radio signals are the first thing that really comes to mind?
Not really. Depending on who you talk to, the chances of a species, life evolving some sort of sentience like we have here on Earth. Some people seem to think that's likely. Some of the people think it's not. And again, we're dealing with a sample of one, so it's really hard to get any kind of feel for how likely that would be. To me, though, I think the biggest detractor would be that consider that the entire lifetime of the Earth, 4.5 billion years, and consider how long of that span there has been a species that's been capable of sending out radio signals.
Not very long.
In 20 or 30 years out of a span of 4.5 billion.
You bet.
And for us to receive that, some other species would have to be in that kind of a span right at the exact same time we are.
And, of course, we may well pass the need for that kind of communication radiation within another 100 years or so.
Yeah,
Doctor,
there's no way to know that. And how typical are we? We don't know that either.
Great. Doctor, it has been a pleasure. And I would like to have you back again and again as the comet does its thing over the next couple of months. So if you would agree to that, we'd love to have you back.
We'd probably work something like that. I don't see why not.
All right. Dr. Hale, thank you.
You're welcome.
And good night. From the high desert, folks, a very good location to view the comet. I want to thank Dr. Alan Hale for being here, and he will be back. From the high desert, this is the CBC Radio Network.